chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, 180 years ago this week, Nat Turner was captured and hanged for his role in the slave rebellion and massacre that took the lives of about 60 white people. So the question for us today, that long afterwards, was Nat Turner a terrorist, or was he an early hero of the anti-slavery struggle? And so I've got the expert here to answer that question for me, and she is Sharon Ewell Foster. She's the author of many books, but the recently published book, The Resurrection of Nat Turner, Part One, The Witnesses. And it's, Sharon, thanks for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this book, The Resurrection of Nat Turner, is it fiction or fact?
Well, I guess it's somewhere in the middle. When I started writing, there's a primary historical source document called The Confessions of Nat Turner by an attorney named Thomas Gray, who said he was Nat Turner's lawyer. And so I was going to write a work that was completely fiction. I was going to base it on that. But I wanted to humanize him. I wanted to write about his mother, write some about his wife and his child. But as I started doing research, I found out that everything was not what it appeared to be. And so the book is as much about the facts that I actually learned as it is about fiction.
Let me see if I can put this in my words. And then you tell me, you correct me, but okay. This is historical fiction.
Yes.
But historical fiction has to be based on actual history and facts as we know them.
Yes.
And as you started writing this book, what you found out was that the history on which other people were writing fiction about Nat Turner was not altogether accurate. Is that about right?
That's right. And not only was the fiction written about him, the basis for people's fiction, the basis even for the history that has been written, was more fiction than fact. Mm-hmm.
It was not that our... Your argument is, based on your research, is that the history that we – puts fiction aside – that the history that we read about Nat Turner is based on fiction itself.
Is based on fiction.
And what did you learn – what is the story as we know it today, or as many people know it today, and then what is the real – put aside the fictional aspects from your book, but what – what history did you have to correct in order to move forward with your historical fiction?
The history says that Thomas Gray was Nat Turner's attorney, that Nat Turner confessed in court, and that he was hanged based on that confession. That's what the historical document says, the pamphlet called The Confessions of Nat Turner. But I went to the town where the trial took place, which used to be called Jerusalem, by the way, and is now called Cortland, and saw the actual trial records. And the actual trial records say that William Parker was Nat Turner's attorney, not Thomas Gray, that Nat Turner didn't confess. He pled innocent. So the whole document then is
you think
is
that the confessions, which are purportedly what Nat Turner told his lawyer in the court, mm-hmm. is a fabrication of this lawyer who was not Nat Turner's lawyer.
Yes, there was something else going on. There was a scam going on, and to explain it to you, I kind of have to set the backdrop of what was going on. This, you know, we have this image of slavery all being about large plantations with hundreds of slaves, wealthy farm owners. And but that's not what was going on in this case. They were really poor farms, really poor white farmers. And most of them, in particular in this area called Cross Keys, had very few slaves. And the farm owners themselves were starving and not doing well. Where in other counties in Virginia, farmers may have made like $400 or $500 a year. In Southampton County, they were making about $150 a year. So, I mean, it's not difficult to imagine that if the farmers are struggling, that the slaves definitely aren't faring well. So then happens Nat Turner's revolt.
Let me interrupt you for a couple of things.
Yes.
Try not to get off track, but
yes.
This is in Southampton County, Virginia. And
yes.
This is right on the North Carolina line, so it's
yes.
almost in North Carolina. In fact, Northampton County
is
in North Carolina is right up. They're just part and parcel of the same kind of area.
Yes.
And
yes.
What you said to me, what said just now, strikes me as revolutionary in terms of our understanding of history, and that is that poor, whatever we've heard, that there were poor white farmers or lower middle class farmers, depending on how you put it, were struggling.
Were poor,
but slaves cost a lot of money, so they were able somehow or another to get a slave or two who would live on their farm with them and be maybe even a family. But usually one or two are slaves on the and like, you know, you just forgive me if this is, but like a cow or, you know, a chicken that a poor chickens of farm animals, a horse,
mm-hmm.
you'd want a slave if you could afford it because that slave could do a lot of work for you and you keep you from being even poorer.
Well, a lot of work. It was also a status symbol. Thomas Jefferson, our illustrious president, had said that all gentlemen farmers should have at least one or two slaves. So here were people who couldn't feed their families who were struggling to keep up with this ideal of having these slaves. And so I guess they were able to do some work for them, but it also involved their being able to vote because voting rights were tied to property. And my daughter sitting here, the expert, I'm looking at her now, wanting to have her join in. But the slave ownership was also tied to voting. So yes, they were really poor. It wasn't always difficult to get a slave for a lot of money. As a matter of fact, Nat Turner was sold for almost a pittance, and so was his wife and child
pittance
to another
meaning,
person.
I mean, you got a dollar figure. I mean, it's not wouldn't be the
maybe,
same, but $100 or $1,000.
I'm trying to remember what the cost was for her, but it seems like it was around $100. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a lot of money. But so, yes, these poor farmers somehow got these slaves. They may have been handed down from a family member. But anyway, they had slaves that they weren't able to really afford, like a poor man having a Cadillac, you know, and only these are human beings. And again, if the family themselves weren't able to eat, then you can imagine how it was for the slaves. The slave owners were living in, we always see images of plantations, these great homes in our minds. They were living in shacks. I mean, and when I'm saying shacks, one of the slave owners was named Salathiel Francis, and his home was maybe like the size of two outhouses put together. So we're talking small, and he lived in that small shack with his slave. So this is not the slavery we've been told about.
Well, this Nat Turner that we're focusing on, was he a slave of a wealthy Virginian, or was he the slave of one of these poor people that you've been talking about?
He was in this poor area, Cross Keys. His original owner, who some of the local historians say was also his father, but that's a whole nother story, seems sort of like a middle class kind of farmer. And he was sold to someone else who it looks like was more middle class. But it's difficult to tell. What I can say is that it doesn't look like the farmer that bought him the second time paid a great deal right. for him.
We're going to have to take a quick break. We're visiting with Sharon Yule Foster about her book, The Resurrection of Nat Turner. She and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about Nat Turner. This month, in fact, this week, is the 180th anniversary of Nat Turner's hanging after the slave revolt, which took place during the preceding several months. And Sharon Foster has written her a book and a follow-up, written two volumes, The Resurrection of Nat Turner. This one, part one, is The Witnesses. And, you know, I'm going to getting you off track all the
That's
time,
okay.
but where we started was on the question of how does the history that everybody thinks there is about Nat Turner, how has it been changed by your research? And one of the things that we talked about in the last hour was that an understanding about how the institution of slavery was working in this in the part of Virginia where Nat Turner lived, part of Virginia right on the North Carolina line where Nat Turner lived. What else was different from the or is different in your point of view from your study of the history about the Nat Turner Rebellion?
Well, I was going to tell you what I was giving you that the background about their poverty to talk about what happened after the revolt. After the revolt, the militia from all over the area, from North Carolina, from Virginia, descended on this little town. And they were killing anything black, it seems like, that they could get their hands on. They were torturing them. There's a
These
sign.
These are blacks, mostly enslaved people, but some free blacks. Whether or not they were participating in the rebellion.
It didn't matter whether they were participating in the rebellion or not. And as a matter of fact, it looks like there were also some Nottoway Indians involved. And there may have even been one white guy whose name was Barry Newsom, who was an indentured servant.
Well, now, is this different from the history that we've known before?
Yes. Yes, because the spin that it was given was that it was just some wild, crazy slaves who had gotten out of hand, and not that all these other people were involved, that there were free men involved, that there were, again, some Nottoway Indians involved, and at least one white man. And when you think about this different view of the army, then it looks more like liberation. It looks more like they were fighting for liberation. But anyway, so the area is really poor. I'm going to fight my way back to the story.
I'm sorry. You just go. You can go right there. I'll try not to get in your way.
No. It's just that the area was really poor. They killed all these slaves and freemen. It was like anybody they could get their hands on. And one of really the only thing that's left of them and what happened to them in this atrocity is there's still a street sign in Southampton County called Blackhead Signpost Road. And when you drive past it, you just think, oh, the Blackhead family lives here. But what it is it's the place where they impaled people. And so it was Blackhead Signpost Road. But anyway, eventually the governor sent in troops because there was a congressman involved. There's always a congressman involved. And the congressman was contacted the governor and told him that 200 or 300 runaway slaves from the Great Dismal Swamp had come and there was a general uprising against all white people and that they needed troops to come in and quell the uprising. Well, when the troops got there, they were led by General Epps. General Epps said, there's nothing here, and that what he had to do instead was stop the militia from killing, and that the other thing that he saw was that the people were starving, so he had his troops give the white people their food. So this is Poe. That's why I keep saying this is like super poor. But so what he did was he went around with people and they weren't sure who was involved, but they picked up people they thought were likely, like people that were, I guess, had been boisterous or out of hand, out of place, probably like me. So
like your regular well-known troublemakers, whether they were in the
I'm thinking about it now. I'm thinking I might have been there. But they put them in jail, and then they started having trials. Well, very shortly, what seems like happened is that some of the farm owners realized that every time a slave was convicted, they got money. So if you're making $150 a year and a slave is turned in and hanged, then you might get back $300, $400, $500. The highest figure I remember was $600. So one young man in particular who was 24 years old, his name was Nathaniel Francis. Nathaniel Francis made more money off of the slave trials than anyone else. He made almost $3,000 over the course of the trials. And names that keep coming up together are Nathaniel Francis, this guy who was like the star witness for the Commonwealth, Levi Waller, and then Thomas Gray. Their names keep coming.
This is the lawyer who wrote
said,
the
now
discredited Confessions of Nat Turner.
Yes. And so Nathaniel Francis would turn in one of his slaves and say they were involved in it. Levi Waller would testify against the slave. And at least on four occasions, Thomas Gray acted as the defense attorney for the slaves, and he would give no defense. So it was an open and shut case. I guess they'd get the money and go. Well, this kept happening over and over again. And what Levi Waller testified was that he was an eyewitness and that he saw his family being massacred in front of him. He said, the first time he testified, he said that he and his family were in their home and that the slaves rode up on horseback with guns and that he and his family tried to run out of the house, but he was the only one that got away. Now, I'm a mother, and that just didn't sit well with me because I thought, you know, my kids are grown now, but if someone was attacking my children, they'd just have to kill me. But anyway, he said he ran away and he jumped over a fence and into some weeds, and then magically these slaves that were after him couldn't see him. He said that he was hiding in the weeds and he saw some slaves go into his home, and he knows that they killed his family because they came out carrying his wife's necklace in their hands. The next time he testified, he told the story differently. He said that they knew the slaves were coming, but he couldn't, but his family couldn't get away. He was the only one that got away, but then he crept back up to the house and looked in the window and saw them killing his family. So each time he's telling a different story, but nobody's questioning him. If Levi Waller said it happened, the slave is convicted. So this went on and on, and Nathaniel Francis getting richer and richer and building more onto his house, because there's a picture of what his house looked like, I guess, after he got the money. But finally, at Nat Turner's trial, Thomas Gray wasn't the attorney. William Parker was the attorney. And William Parker had been the attorney at other slave trials and had actually gotten some of the slaves acquitted. So when you read the trial records, you can see William Parker
He's active. He's doing as good a job as he can.
Yes, yes. And so I'm not sure what happened, but Levi kind of fell apart and started telling a different story. And I don't know whether he was drunk or what, but Levi was a known moonshiner. And at Nat Turner's trial, Levi said he was at his still. So now you've got all these trials that have happened where they've defrauded the Commonwealth of Virginia because Levi has said he saw it. Now he's saying he was at his still. And I, you know, I could only imagine what was happening in the courtroom. But then the congressman who was sitting in court as a judge, I mean, this is a lot to take in. Then he starts giving testimony and saying that Nat Turner confessed to him before Nat Turner was taken into custody. And the whole thing was botched. They hung him anyway. Of course they were going to hang him. But I think they had to come up with something, some smoke and mirrors to take the eyes off of the scam and also to justify them hanging Nat Turner, because at that point, when Levi collapsed, they had no witnesses because Levi was the only witness against Nat Turner.
So is it your, I mean, this is a whole a new pale of information, a pail full of information that has not been carefully considered by the historians as they try to figure out what happened. But bottom line, did you're not arguing that Nat Turner didn't lead this rebellion?
Oh, I think he was. I think he led the rebellion. I think that some of the people that were convicted were involved in the rebellion, not all, but they couldn't prove it.
So this is, I mean, this is interesting, is that maybe if using today's judicial standards, you look at this trial and say, Nat Turner may have done this, but he couldn't have been found guilty based on the evidence presented in court.
Mm-hmm.
But we all know he did it.
Well,
or do we?
Well, we know he did it, but what was the basis of his doing it? I mean, We live in a country that says it is our duty to take up arms against tyrants. We sing the Star Spangled Banner that says, and then conquer we must when our cause it is just. And, you know, I guess the face of who is a tyrant shifts in this case. And I think that's part of what's uncomfortable about looking at Nat Turner and taking an honest look back at slavery. I've had people say to me, well, why write this book? Why would you write this? I think that we're mature enough now as a nation to look back at it and go, wow, we were crazy. I mean, and so I don't know. I think that part of I intended when I wrote to be objective. But after years, when I finally realized what happened, when I finally realized the scam that was going on and realized that the people that were telling the story of who Nat Turner was were people that were willing to turn in people and have them killed just for a little money in their pocket, then it shifted who was the bad guy.
Oh, well, we need to take a break. I hate to interrupt this because this is really important. We're talking about Nat Turner and his rebellion, and we're talking with Sharon Yule Foster, who's the author of a new book, The Resurrection of Nat Turner, and she and I will be right back.
chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com, more of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Sharon Ewell Foster. She is the she's the author of a new book called The Resurrection of Nat Turner, and it's, I don't know, it's coincidentally, maybe, or maybe we did this because we planned it, but this week is the anniversary, the 180th anniversary of the execution, the hanging of Nat Turner. And Sharon, before the break, you and I are about to get off on different paths because, and let me try to set it up like I'm seeing our sort of different views of this, and then I want you to, I'm going to give you the floor. Because, but what I'm saying is all of the research that you've done and finding out that this trial was a series of, as we can say, scams, but it was of, there were many misrepresentations and secondary
I think scam
plots
is good.
That were going on,
yes.
Where people were using the rebellion and the trials that accompanied it to turn their slaves in, have them executed, and then collect a bounty, sort of a reward from the trial, and getting money from the Commonwealth of Virginia about this, and then that therefore you just have to have questions about the credibility of the whole process. All right, now I agree with that. And then next, I keep pressing, but Nat Turner did lead this rebellion, didn't you? And there seems to be no controversy about that. He did lead the rebellion. But you say, all right, now we get to the second question, and that is, Nat Turner ought to have led this rebellion because the slavery was so terrible and somebody needed to stand up. And in another context, rather than being viewed as a terrorist, as most of us view Nat Turner because that rebellion slaughtered some white families, the other view, had it been successful and he'd been able to overturn slavery, he might have been a George Washington. You know, he would have been. Is that your argument? Sort
of? You know, I don't think that he was. By all accounts, he was a brilliant man, and I don't think that he thought that he had the power, the juice, with no weapons, because there are arguments in the trial about whether they had guns or not. I don't think that he thought that he was going to be able to take over all of Virginia and overturn slavery that way. I do think that what it did was to cause people to focus, to see that slavery was not what he was pretending to be, that the slaves were not content, that they were not happy. And I think that we have to... part of what I tried to do in the book is to help people to see these people not as slaves, but as captives, to think of them as no different than themselves. Because part of our psychology, I think, of coping with slavery in the United States is that we see them as a thing, as a different kind of thing, rather than as human beings. So this is a man who had a wife, who had a child, and his wife and child were sold away to another farm, which means that he no longer is able to live with his wife and with his child. It also means that this other man now has access to his wife.
This is the owner, the new slave owner.
The new slave owner. And so if you can imagine yourself in that position, you know, I know that psychologically, I think it's difficult for us to go there because we don't want to go there. We just want to go, well, that's how it was. But they didn't feel any different as human beings than we do. It's like we get it when we talk about somebody being trafficked. we get it nowadays. We go, oh, that's horrible. I'm trying to think of the young woman's name whose face is on my mind. She was blonde, and her family is still talking about her. She was allegedly killed in one of the islands. Natalie Holloway. We get it when we talk about Natalie Holloway, that this was a human being with dreams and with a future. But somehow we don't get that.
Let me interrupt you because I'm getting you're persuading me.
Okay.
I mean, sort of. But what you're saying is, imagine what would have happened if one of these people involved in modern trafficking, let's just say one of these young women who has been sort of captured and put into prostitution type slavery, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden one day she wakes up and says, "This is awful. I'm not going to take it anymore." And so she kills the people who got her enslaved. Mm-hmm. Well, we would say she shouldn't have done that, but we sure understand why she did it, and maybe, my golly, good for her for rising up. Is that sort of what you were doing?
I don't even know if we'd say she shouldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. I think we'd probably go, you know, good for her. She got away. They got what they deserved. And that's hard. I mean, that's really hard, but
Nat Turner's sort of in that position as far as you see it, that good for him.
Well, I think that and this was part of my struggle writing the book, is trying to put myself in the position of someone who has been in this position not 1 year, not 2 years, not 3 years. This is 31 years of this. And before him, there's his mother's generation who has been through this. And then all these people around you, you see this going on. So this isn't even one person. I think that's hard for us to grasp. That's difficult. That's probably impossible for us because we live in the land of the free. But what I can tell you is that Nat Turner pled innocent, and if you look at the trials transcripts of the other slaves that were involved, all of them pled innocent. And that didn't just happen. If I get 50 people in a room and I'm the law and I tell them I'm taking you to court, I can't get 50 of them to plead innocent. All of them pled innocent. And I think it was because they felt they were right, that they were right to take up arms against tyrants. And it wasn't against all the white people, even though that's the way it was pitched. There were farms that they passed by, slave-owning farms of white people that they passed by that were never touched. There were Quaker farms that were passed by that were never touched. So this wasn't like a general uprising against all whites. It was very targeted and very focused. And so, you know, I'm sitting here. I didn't eat this morning, but I could have. And I drove here in a car, and there's nobody with chains on me. And so it's difficult for me to understand what they felt like. But when I try to put myself there, I get it. I part of me gets it. And even though I'm a peaceful person, and I don't want to fight, If I think I looked around and I got to the point where I finally said, you know, there's no other door open to me, I don't know that I can say that I wouldn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, what does our mm-hmm. country do? I mean, there are points, and you're right. So how is he different from George Washington? And how is he different from Nathan Hale? I think what makes it different for us is who the victims were, because we have this shifting thing. Are you tyrant, or are you a great American? Yeah. And I think that's hard.
Well, the problem for this side is that some of the victims of the rebellion were women, children, innocent people who
I hope people will read the book, because Nat Turner's mother, according to the local historian, she was Ethiopian. And so I try to tell the story of her being captured of her having a life before she was ever brought to America.
She might have been a slave owner herself before she was
captured. And in the book in Ethiopia, I have her as a slave owner herself. And so to tell that story and to tell the story of all of the children, all of those that were killed in passage. So, you know, how do you separate for that for somebody who's in Nat Turner's position? I guess I'm sounding like his attorney.
You sound like you'd been there. He would have been found. I tell you what, we got to Sharon Ewell Foster. We got to take a break. We're talking about Sharon Ewell Foster's new book, The Resurrection of Nat Turner. And she and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about Nat Turner. You remember the leader of the slave rebellion? Well, it was 180 years ago. In fact, this week we will mark the anniversary, the 180th anniversary of the hanging of Nat Turner. Sharon Ewell Foster's latest book, The Resurrection of Nat Turner, has, although fiction, has put her into studying history and, you know, wrestling with all of the meanings of this, and you're sharing that with us, interrupted only by my challenges. We've only got about just a few minutes left, and what is the bottom line shorthand message when you've got a chance to give, you know, your 30-second or minute spiel about what you've learned and what you think the rest of us ought to learn, or if not learning, what questions should we be asking about Nat Turner?
Well, I'll try to do it in a minute. The thing that's very true is that the Confessions of Nat Turner is penned by Thomas Gray. It's not true that it's a lie that Thomas Gray was not his attorney, that Nat Turner did not confess. He pled innocent. I think also that there was a scam that was going on. I think really what I hope, and part of what's happening in Southampton County right now, is that there are black people and white people reading this book and talking about the book and talking about what it meant to be a slave and talking about the uprising and what it meant in that community. And that's really part of my greatest dream for the book, is that people will read it and put themselves in different viewpoints, because that's part of what I tried to do in the book, is to write in those different viewpoints so people get to sit in them and think about what it actually meant, and to dissolve away this pamphlet that was created really to malign him. That was the whole purpose of the pamphlet. So yes, he's made to look like a crazy person. And then somewhere buried in it, if you'll look at it, and I think it's part of the proof of what I'm saying, buried in there is a paragraph that says, people say that he was what's the opposite of courageous? I can't think of the word.
A coward.
And then it says, but he wasn't a coward, and there's justification. And people say that he was a madman, and then it says, but he wasn't, and that he was the naturally most intelligent person you knew. So buried in there is this one paragraph that says that, no, he wasn't any of these things we're saying he was, and then all this other muck around it that says, you know, he was a crazy baby killer. I think that we need to give Nat Turner another look and at least give him his day in court.
Well, that it starts out in your book, your historical fiction about Nat Turner, based on your understanding of the real history of those events.
Yes.
And we do have just a minute. And one of the things that we haven't covered, for those people who maybe Nat Turner is not well known, you mentioned that he was smart, but he was a deeply religious person. He was a minister. And in your book and in your research, you found out that he was an evangelist. He even saved and baptized white people. This was, so he must have been, and he, although slaves were probably not supposed to learn to read, He was a reader and a student.
He was a reader. He was able to write. He studied the Bible. He was able to quote the Bible. There are stories of him going as far away as Norfolk to preach. And there is a story of him baptizing this one white man who he was supposed to have also prayed for and healed. And the town was in an uproar over him baptizing this guy because this guy was an overseer and he was supposed to have been known to be really cruel to slaves. And then he had this encounter with Nat Turner and got saved and his life was transformed. And eventually the white people ran him out of town, this white guy, because I guess, you know, that's not the story they wanted told. So, I mean, and that doesn't jibe with Nat Turner being this religious fanatic or this black person that hated all white people because he did baptize this guy. I was thinking today that a lot of times the people that get pointed at so many times as fanatics, like Martin Luther King at the time when he was alive, they really are more in the middle and trying to yell and go, hey, wake up, wake up, wake up. But we don't see it that way at the time. They look like fanatics.
Well, that might be a good way. I hate to end this conversation, but you giving us a wake-up call. And so we thank you both for you, for the new book, The Resurrection of Nat Turner, and also for your willingness to come and confront sort of the things that we believed before and persuade us that maybe we ought to take a second look.
Thanks
to Sharon Ewell Foster. And thanks to all y'all for listening. It's been